Okay, shalom uvracha. Hi everyone, welcome. Today is January 24th, 2024, and this is our Denver Kehillah Wednesday night learning. And I welcome you from the four corners of the earth, or the four corners of Winston Downs, whatever the case may be, wherever you are. And it's wonderful to have you. Today is the second of our Judaism and Moral Society series. The first class, last week's class, was a discussion on doing business with unethical companies. And today's topic is going to be a discussion on Judaism and political power. Specifically, how does Judaism view political power? So I thought what we would do as we get started is to sort of open up the floor, if you will, to ask you what your thoughts are. If you have any ideas, any knowledge, anything you've studied about this question. I know it's a broad question. I'll leave it that way on purpose. About this question of Judaism and political power. We're not going to talk contemporary Jewish politics. That's not what we're here to do. We're here to talk about the ideas that we find in classical Jewish sources about political power. So anyone have anything, or maybe a question, or something they may think about when they consider this idea of Judaism and political power?
Didn't the Sanhedrin used to vote on things and go by the majority?
The Sanhedrin did vote on things. That's correct. That's part of the. It's a good question how to categorize, how to silo the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, I would. It's definitely part of the political, the political arrangement. But I would put it. But it's the judiciary. Which is an important part of political power. We're going to spend most of our time talking about the executive, right? The executive branch, if you will, of the Jewish political power structure. But you are correct. The Sanhedrin did vote based on majority.
So wouldn't that mainly be monarchy?
Okay. So Evelyn mentioned something which is a popular and common idea. And I think what you're saying is that the preferred version of Jewish political power is monarchy. Okay? We're going to touch
on that. I'm not saying it was preferred. I'm just saying it was prominent.
Okay, great. So not preferred, but prominent. Okay? We are going to discuss monarchy as well, and how that is viewed in terms of the overall structure of Jewish political power. Excellent. Any other thoughts? Yes.
Jews have always in history, in and out, have been used, you might say, for their opinions on certain situations in a country as advisors.
Okay.
And that is looked on as okay, but we walk a thin line between being an advisor for non-Jews and how that may, how would you put it, impact the Jewish community of that country.
Okay.
Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that there have been when the Jews were not, the masters of their own destiny, they often played a role within the government of the host country that they were in. That's true. In fact, one of the most well-known authors on Jewish political power is the Abarbanel. And the Abarbanel played such a role in the court of Ferdinand and Isabella, as a matter of fact, in Spain. And And that he's just one example of this. We are going to be talking about the situation where the Jews are in charge. Right? What's the nature of Jewish political power when the Jews are the masters of our own fate and we get to govern ourselves entirely? Okay, that's what we're going to be spending time on today. Okay, great. So thank you all for your views and your comments on that. Let me share the screen and we'll jump right into the sources. Okay, so I want to start out by saying that the Jewish view of political power is very much colored by the notion of freedom, which may come as a surprise to us because political power is often about giving up one's freedom. But we're gonna unpack this a little bit. The notion of freedom in Judaism and the moral importance of freedom may be referenced in a series of psukim. I brought just one of them that talks about the creation of humanity. Vayivra Elohim et ha'adam b'tzalmo, b'tzelem Elohim bara oto, zachar u'nekevah bara otam. That God created humanity in the divine image. This idea that we all are created in the divine image is understood broadly to mean that we all have certain, I guess, inalienable rights. It's true that Judaism more often speaks about obligations than rights. But when we talk about being created in the image of God, we're referring to this notion that that really no one should rule over us, right? We are born with human dignity, and because we are created in the image of God, and with that dignity comes freedom, and who has the right to impose their rule over anybody else? It's a very sort of natural and pure way to look at the status of the nature of humanity. The Pirkei Avot builds on this and says, "Chaviv Adam shenivra b'tzelem, ki ba yeterah nodat lo shenivra b'tzelem." Right, beloved is humanity that was created in God's image, and we are especially beloved because we were told about it. That's a really important thing, right? It's one thing to be created in God's image, but it's another thing to know that we are created in God's image, and therefore to know and to be able to claim our dignity and our freedom. So what I'm getting at is, it could be, and I'd love to hear your reaction to this. It could be that the preferred version of government, according to Judaism, is none. Right? It would be best if we would not need anyone to govern us, right? Because by definition, when one is governed by someone or someones, then we are giving up parts of our freedom. I'm not talking about freedom to do harm to people. I'm just talking about freedoms in general. We'll go through a couple of more sources that may bolster this position. And if anyone wants to comment on it, please do. In the meantime, let's look at an early story of a society that we see in the Torah. This is in the beginning of the book of Bereshit. Vayehi kol ha'aretz safa echat udivarim achadim, vayehi b'nasam mikedem. This is the story of Migdal Babel, where the people living in Eret Bik'a be'eret Shinar, they were living in the valley in the land of Shinar, they settled there. And they said, "We're going to make bricks and we're going to build a tower." Vayomru havah nivna lanu ir u'migdal. Let's build a city and a tower. Baroshoba shamayim, its top will be in the sky. Lanu to make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we're going to be scattered all over the land. So, how do you understand this, right? What do you think is what's going on in this story? What are these people trying to accomplish? Anybody want to make a suggestion?
Immortality,
Immortality. Where do you see
fame.
that in the, where do you see that in the verses, Evelyn?
I don't actually see it in the verses, but their idea is to seemingly overpower God.
Okay, so this is viewed as a rebellion against God. Okay? That's one way to look at this for sure. Okay, Mom, go ahead.
I think they were looking for fame.
Okay, for the fame for the just for the purpose of fame.
Well,
Just to be
because
known.
they'll have the biggest tower and they'll be known all over the world, so they'll be famous.
Okay, so they're building this impressive structure so that would they could be famous and well known. Okay, excellent. Any other suggestions? Serena?
I think they wanted to dominate other people and prevent everyone from dispersing and filling the earth and being separate and different. They were trying to be unified, and then I can be the boss.
Okay, excellent. So they are trying to rule over other people. And is there something in this in the language of these psukim that lead you to that conclusion, Serena?
Yeah, I studied this recently with a partner in Torah. Let me see if I can get a good view of it here.
Make it bigger. So.
She and I, we were also very intrigued by somebody who saw that he was going to relocate and not be under Nimrod. This is in the earlier section of who will begat whom.
Okay.
And it seemed that he was a child of Shem and Nimrod was a child of, I think, Ham, I mean, a descendant of, and wherever the, anyway.
Okay, so I hear your point, and it could be that maybe you're referring to this comment that we're going to study now from Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He has two fascinating comments that look at this not so much as a rebellion against God, but rather as which is a common, well-known appreciation and understanding of these verses, but rather as Serena said, an attempt to tyrannically rule over other people. So commenting on this part of the pasuk that says the top of the tower reached the sky, the Netziv, you see here is years 1816 to 1893, very important a personality. He wrote amongst other things a well-known commentary on the Torah, and he was the head of the Wallachian or yeshiva in Poland. He writes as follows. It is obvious that you should not think that this would be one city to the whole world. Rather, they thought that the other nearby cities would be subjects to that city and that had a tower that they would be able to see from it to the distance over all their settlement so that no one would be able to separate themselves and go to another land. Fascinating. And according to the Netziv, this was an observation tower. And people from the ruling class would be up there in this very high tower and able to see for miles and miles around to make sure that people weren't leaving. Right? They had no emigration policy because these people wanted to be in charge of everybody else. And then they say the following. They also, the Netziv is wondering why the Torah tells us, interesting, why the Torah has to tell us how they made the bricks, that they made them through putting them in a furnace. Everyone knows how you make bricks, right? Why are we told this detail? So the Netziv says that's because it has nothing to do with how they made bricks. He says as follows: burn them thoroughly. There is no place in the text where something is told that no impact in the story. Therefore, why do I care if they were burnt using stone bricks, were constructing using wood, or made their brick by burning? Even before the flood, it is written, and afterward he built a city, and it appears that here there was a hint regarding our sages' tradition that Avraham Avinu was thrown into the fiery furnace. You know that midrash? That Avram was thrown into the furnace and that God saved him. There is no real proof, since from the sample meaning it is simply the name of the place, or Kazdim, however. But from here we have a hint to the issue of what obviously was happening before the tradition, saying that they threw Avram Avinu into the fiery furnace. They did not make the furnace for this need of bricks. Rather, this was the fiery furnace done for the need of burning people. And the text is informing that this furnace was for the need of the city and the tower. And from this, we understand how big and deep was this furnace. And from this furnace, Aram was saved. So the picture that the Netziv is painting is that this was a tyrannical society that wanted to control the movement of all of its people. I don't want to call it citizens, but all of its people, to the point that when you would disobey, they would throw a person. If a person would disobey, they would throw the person into the furnace. The furnace wasn't for the brick. And what does God do to this? God destroys this, right? So according to the Netziv, this is a story which is placed at the beginning of the Torah, teaching us God's opposition to tyranny, right? God's opposition to forced rule of one or a group of people over other people. And this may very well go back to the pasuk that we started with, that God created all of us, B'Tselem Elokim, in God's image. And of course, we see this again. Where do we see this again? In the parshiyot that we just finished reading about a Shibud Mitzrayim. Right, about the slavery in Egypt. That is also a story of God bringing down a society, much the way he brought down. There are parallels, right? They're building in the story of Migdal Bavel, they're building in the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. There's bricks in the story of Migdal Bavel, and there's bricks in the story of Mitzrayim. There's mistreatment in the story of Migdal Bavel, and there's mistreatment in the story of Mitzrayim. These are parallel stories. At the beginning of time, God sets a precedent that tyranny is not acceptable. And when Bnei Yisrael is about to take their first steps as a nation, he also reiterates this idea that tyranny is not going to be allowed to exist. So this could be one sort of important element of how we understand Judaism and political power. And that is, when it comes that political power, especially tyrannical political power, is in opposition to the Torah value of freedom. And sometimes God steps in to remove those tyrannical powers. Okay. I want to stop here and see if anyone has a question or a comment. Anyone?
So this is just how Jews would be ruling other Jews, correct? It wouldn't be Jews ruling non-Jews, and then if they disobey, they throw them in the furnace. I mean, that
No,
goes back a long ways. Hamas is using that now.
these weren't Jews,
Amazing.
right? This story in Bereshit isn't about Jews. It's about people tyrannically ruling over other people. And the
Not
Torah,
about Hebrews.
No.
It's way before the
For sure. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And where is Shinar or Shinar? Is that in Iraq today?
It's possible. I'm actually not sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Along the same lines, this the idea that Judaism is really opposed to people losing their freedom towards other people. We have this. We know that sometimes a person, in order to pay off a debt, would sometimes have to work. They would have to work off their debt, and after a certain amount of time, the Torah says that they're free. But the Torah also recognizes that sometimes the person did not want to be free, and they wanted to stay in this type of servitude. And the Gemara here teaches us that that this is not a good idea. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had doresh hamikra hazeh kimin chomer manishtana ozen mikol evarim shebaguf. So if a person decides that they want to stay in this status of servitude, the Torah says that they have to have their ear pierced against the door. So the question is, why the ear? So Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so the Gemara says that God said, Ozen sheshama koli al har Sinai basha'ash amarti ki li v'nei Yisrael avadim. The ear that heard me on Sinai said that the children of Israel are my servants, v'lo avadim la'avadim, and not servants to servants, v'halach zeh v'kana adon la'atzmo, and nevertheless willingly went to acquire a master for themselves, yeratzeh. That ear should be pierced. So this actually may be the clearest indication of what the Torah is after. If I would ask again, what type of political power is the Torah after? And I suggested earlier, none. Then the question is, okay, then what are the rules? Well, here we have it. The rules are the Torah, right? That's what ultimately could be. Now, we know that has not worked. And I'm not suggesting that it's easy to make it work, but I'm suggesting that ideally, the Torah's view of political power is very negative, and that exercising political power against someone else means that they are an eved to an eved, right? That we are servants to servants because we are God's servants. Everyone is God's servant, and when we give up our freedom to someone else, we are essentially saying, I'm not going to be God's servant. I'm going to be the servant of a servant. Okay. So that's sort of the case to be made, I think, about the Jewish view of political power.
So can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Not really a question, but the idea being, which I think is what you're saying, is the Torah should suffice as the governing body, follow the rules in the Torah, and you don't need governing councils. You don't need kings, you don't need anything. But we see as early as, next week's Parsha that we're supposed to make, descending courts of law.
Right, that's true. Okay, so that's true. As I think someone mentioned Sanhedrin earlier, Achaim did. That's true because it ideally we all follow the rules. If we don't follow the rules, then there's a judiciary, right? And the judiciary would punish, but that is not the executive making rules. We're self-governing until we're not, and when we're not, we have a judiciary. Now, it could be that this is an example of the Torah being cognizant of human nature. Ideally, we shouldn't even need the shoftim. We shouldn't even need the judiciary. But the Torah recognizes that that's just not the way human nature operates, and that from time to time people are going to veer off the straight and narrow. But it doesn't stop the Torah from providing what is the ideal version of political power. And we're going to actually see that right now, because not only do we do, and you're right, because the first example of judiciary power is when Yitro comes to Moshe and says, "Hey, you're too busy. People aren't having their questions answered. Let's devise a court system." So you're 100% right. So it's very interesting, actually, if you think about it, the genesis of Jewish political power starts with the judiciary. And only later do we look at an executive. Now, it's true that we could view Moshe as a king, possibly, but the first explicit discussion in the Torah about someone being in charge, it's not executive power, it's judiciary power, which I think is maybe surprising to people in terms of how we set things up. But it's actually not surprising in Judaism, because while we're not going to have a chance to get into much of this today, the judiciary actually has very much control over the executive, right? The judiciary, first of all, appoints the king. They could impeach the king. They could call the king to court. A lot of things are, it's like very in the moment about what the executive privileges are and what they're not in the Torah. Okay. But now, notwithstanding this notion of a dislike of tyranny and political power, we do have a pasuk in the Torah that talks about an executive, a king, right? And that is, let me just quickly number these sources so we can look what we're looking at here. This is source number 11. I'm sorry, source number 10. Kitavo el haaretz, when we come to the land where God is going to give us, v'amarta asima alai melech kichol hagoyim asher sivivotai. And you will say, "I want a king like all the other nations." Som tasim alecha melech. Okay, then go ahead and appoint a king that God will choose. Mikerav achecha tasim alecha melech. Lo tuchal atet alecha ish nachri asher lo achicha hu. Okay. What, let me ask you a question. What's the nature of this pasuk? Right, there are different types of psukim in the Torah. There's narrative. There are historical. There are psukim that give us mitzvot, mitzvot aseh, mitzvot lo taseh, right? Positive, negative. How would you characterize? Or maybe I'm missing it. How would you characterize this pasuk? Not this series of psukim.
So it's instruction, but isn't the message before that God really doesn't want them to have a king, but the people clamor for a king, so he says, okay, take a king, but you'll regret it.
Well, there's nothing in these psukim that indicate that God doesn't want a king. You're jumping ahead a few hundred years.
I have an idea.
But so Evelyn, you're saying that it seems to be a mitzvah, but it doesn't really like have that strong commanding language.
Yeah,
It's
it's more of
sort
an
of like,
instruction.
I think within the narrative, if you want this, then you can do it. But it doesn't sound like you must have a king. Okay. Serena.
Yeah, I'm coming back. If there's one of the seven mitzvot of Noah is that you have to have some or other form of government. So this was already your opening question. Do we need government at all? So then, yes, Jews also should have government if every child of Noah should have government. And my question on that is, where is the source? Like, I don't really understand anyway for most of those seven commandments of Noah where the source is in Chumash.
Wow. Okay. So you are correct that one of the Shev Mitzvah Noach is setting up a court system. But again, that's judiciary. The executive rules come from the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Those are the rules. They have to
But
live by.
where is the rule given? Because if you're going to have a judiciary to say you shouldn't have murdered, then there has to be a rule that said you're not allowed to murder.
Those are learned out by Chazal. We can go over those another time from the very beginning of the Torah. And there's a Gemara that lays out how we learn those sources. But you are correct. And like we said before, actually it mirrors what we said before. For B'nai Noach and for Jews, the first type of government we encounter is explicitly, well, I'm not sure if it's explicit for B'nai Noach, but certainly for Jews. But you're right, the government, there is sort of a governmental structure required of B'nai Noach, but that is judiciary to judge when people are not following the Shem Mitzvah B'nai Noach. Okay, so we have the Psukim in Devarim. That's a great point, Serena. We have the Psukim in Devarim that talk about this mitzvah, but not really, of having a king. And then we have this midrash that comments on this. And I'd like you to sort of characterize what you think the rabbis are saying here. The Gemara, the midrash says, "Kitavo l'aretz," when you come to the land, Rabbanan Amri, the rabbis taught, "Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu LiYisrael, Banai." God said to the people of Israel, "My children, Kach chashavti she'tehiyu chorin min hamalchut minayin." I wanted you to be free of kingship. This may be the most explicit reference to what I said before, that the Torah doesn't really want government. Right? And it doesn't mean by the way, that the Torah wants anarchy. It's the opposite. The Torah doesn't want human government. It wants God and the Torah. Right? So, my children, I have thought to let you be free from kingship. How do we know this? He quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. Pera lamud midbar, kishem shapera gadel b'midbar, ve'ein eimat adam alav, kach chashavti shelo tehe eimat malchut aleichem. Just like a donkey grows up and they're free, I wished for you also to be free, and you would not have the fear of any kingship upon you. Aval atem lo bikashtem kein, but you did not want this. Right, so what are the rabbis saying here about this pasuk? These psukim in source number 10. What do they feel about this possibility? Right? They're reading the sort of the understanding of their understanding of the Torah again is that there should be no executive. There should be no one making additional rules. You're supposed to be free, which in the Torah means free to serve God, and not avadim la avadim, and not servants to servants. Which brings us to the famous story in Shmuel Aleph, when Bnei Yisrael, when they see that Shmuel is getting old, he's the shofet. They see he's and the Navi, they see he's getting old. They say, you know what? We need a king now because you're going to die, and your children aren't following your footsteps. We need a king. And Shmuel is upset in Pasuk Vav. Vayera hadavar b'nei Shmuel. Shmuel was displeased when they said this, and God said, "Listen to what God says. God says, don't worry, Shmuel. That it's not about you. It's about me." Right? I'm sure we've all heard that in our romantic lives. It's not you, it's me. Right? Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel Shema b'kol ha'am l'chol asher yomru elecha ki lo otcha ma'asu ki oti ma'asu mimloch aleihem. Here also a pretty straightforward reference to this idea. They're not rejecting you as their king, they're rejecting me as their king. K'chol ha'asim asher asu miyom ha'aloti otam mimitzrayim v'ad hayom hazeh. Vayazvuni vayavdu Elohim acherim ki hema osim gamlach. Just like they forsake me, they're also forsaking you. But really, as he says, this is about me. Many people view these two psukim, the pasuk in Devarim, that it's okay to have a king, and the pasuk in and the psukim in Shmuel, where God is very upset about them having a king, as being in conflict with one another. The Gemara in Sanhedrin sees differently, that in Devarim, it's saying that they're allowed to have a king. And in Shmuel, it seems to be that what God is upset about is why they're asking for a king, because they don't want God to rule over them. If they wanted a king, let's say perhaps to lead them into war, if they wanted the king to do something else, a leader, maybe that would be okay. But it doesn't sound that way. And so maybe that's why God is upset, and these psukim are not really in conflict with one another. And what's really interesting about this is this comment of Abarbanel. Abarbanel, as I mentioned before, was in the court of Ferdinand and Isabella, and he writes the following. He's trying to understand what was wrong with Bnei Yisrael's request for a king in Shmuel, that God gets so upset and Shmuel gets so upset. So he says, "Im haita sheilat ha'melach b'stam divar na'ot. If the only problem in Shmuel was the way they asked, meaning really it's a mitzvah to have a king, it's a good idea to have a king, but they like one may interpret the psukim in Devarim. But what Bnei Israel did, their sin was the way they asked, or the purpose, or the time, or their intent. Lama im kein Yehoshua v'shar shoftei Yisrael sheba'u acharav v'lo hit'oruru lahamlich melech." This is a great question. If it's really a good idea to have a king, and the only reason Shmuel was upset is because they asked for the wrong purpose, why is it that from the time of Yoshua all the way to Shmuel, none of the Nevi'im and none of the Shoftim appointed a king? Kevan Shaitah mitzvah aleihem b'achnasatam le'eretz Yisrael. They should have done it as soon as they entered into Eretz Israel. Ve'ech avru kula malzot ha-mitzvah bi'otam be'eretz acharei ha-kibush v'chiluk. If it's a mitzvah, how is it possible that all of these leaders were in violation of this mitzvah from the time that Bnei Israel conquered the land and divided it amongst the shvatim, amongst the tribes? So the upshot of this is, it must not be. There must be no obligation to have an executive ruler. Bnei Israel wanted one, but there's no obligation to have an executive ruler. If there was an obligation of executive ruler, it should have been taken care of immediately upon entry into Eretz Yisrael. I think that's a really, really great insight by Abarbanel, which sort of again bolsters our idea that the Torah is not really interested in an executive leader. Now, what type of executive leader should there be if Bnei Israel want one? That's another question. That's a big debate, whether it needs to be a king or whether there could be some type of representative government or something like that. That's a separate question that we're not really getting into today. But whether or not there should be, the evidence is mounting, right, that maybe the Torah is not even interested, ideally, again, ideally, in there being a king, or any type of executive, for that matter. And here's another midrash where the rabbi sort of trashed the idea of a king, of a leader. And he will say, "I will appoint for me a king." Our rabbi said the Holy Spirit, "You want kings in this world? Jewish kings will be appointed, and they will make you fall by the sword. Shaul caused them to fall at Har Gilboa. and Ach, and then Tzidkiah caused the destruction of the Holy Temple. And he goes on and on to list, right, the failures of executive governments, which again, the rabbis may be saying, their way of saying that, generally speaking, even though maybe they're necessary, governments are not ideal. Okay. This is the Nitziv also saying something similar, that it wasn't a mitzvah. I want to add one other thing. So I want to sort of, I'll stop there and say the case I was trying to make tonight was that there seems to be a preponderance, is that the word, of evidence that ideally the Torah is not is opposed, based on the notion of freedom, is opposed to us giving up our freedom to any other human being. Now, that's not the same as a judiciary, as we saw, and it may also be too idealistic and not something that is actually possible within most human societies. But ideally, the Torah is interested in our developing a society based on the ideals and the rules of the Torah, without a need for someone to be in charge of us. That's sort of the point number one. I just want to take another minute. That at first glance, may teach us something else, but ultimately I don't think it is. This is the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that says, Rabbi Chanina Sgan HaKonim Omer, Hevei Mitpalel B'Shlomah Shel Malchut, She'ilmalei Mora'a Ish Et Re'ehu Chayim Bilo'o. We should pray for the welfare of the government, and this may refer to a foreign government even, and this is, by the way, the main source that we have for the recitation of the prayer for the welfare of the government of the United States or wherever you live. There's such a prayer based on this, because if not for the fear of the government, everyone would swallow their neighbor alive, right? Anarchy would ensue. So there's a really fascinating commentary on the Pirkei Avot, a contemporary one. It's called Mishnat Eretz Yisrael. And you see, it's written by two professors. One of them is Zev Safrai and his daughter Chana Safrai. And they have a commentary on, I think, every tractate of the Mishnah, focusing mostly on the connection between the Mishnah and Eretz Yisrael. That's why it's called Mishnat Eretz Yisrael. But they say something really fascinating here. They say that this Mishnah is not talking about the government protecting Jews from the sort of hooligans in the neighborhood, or from anti-Semites. Listen to what they say. I thought it's a fascinating take. Kolomar hamalchut migina aleinu lo yivlaunu. Oh, I'm sorry. It's the opposite of what I said. That the Jews had a negative view of their Gentile neighbors, and the government's role was to protect the Jews because they're a minority. That's the government's role. You want to look for a positive need for government? The positive for government may be to protect the rights of the minority. Zayam atzab b'mei ha'beinayim. This was the situation in the Middle Ages. V'ulai gam b'tkufat ha'mishnah. This also may have been the situation in the time of the Mishnah. V'derech klal mekorot chazal mashkifim yachas uyan al ha'shultan ha'romi. Generally speaking, there's a negative view of the Romans in the eyes of the rabbis. And generally, the rabbinic sources don't distinguish between the Roman government and the general population. This statement of Rabbi Hananiah is out of the ordinary and surprising, shocking. Here, as opposed to the normal general negative view that Jews express to the government, here it's positive. This Mishnah recognizes the existing danger towards minorities that only the government can protect against. Umatzbia al tfisa yotzeit dofen shel havanat shorshei haskana al anachrim. Machashash eino me'ashulton ela me'atzipur hapagani. The fear that's expressed in this Mishnah is not against the government, which is the normal way that Chazal speak, but against the pagan citizenry. Vashulton hu davka haguf ha'misayeya umatzil. And the government, precisely, are the people that protect the minority. It's not to say that the government of Rome was desired, or that it was particularly righteous. But it was the force that protected the Jewish population. This is one of the many surprising statements that we find in Pirkei Avot. So I thought this was fascinating in the sense that when we are on our own, we don't want a government. We would hope that our rules also protect the minority. But the one time a minority is good is when we are not the master of our own fate. And therefore, we need the government to take care of us. And so here, this Mishnah is viewed not as the government being the problem, but the government actually being the solution and protecting the Jews when they are in a minority position. It's not 100% connected to what we said before, but I wanted to share it because I thought it was really fascinating and a very different take of how Chazal looked at governments that were the host government that we were in, which is something we started talking about at the beginning. So we're gonna stop here. There is more discussion, as you see on the source sheet, about if there needs to be a government, what are the checks and balances on that government? And there are a whole bunch of them. Who appoints the executive? Who appoints the executive? Does the judiciary have the right to fire the executive? Can the executive be sued and taken to court? Can criminal charges be taken against the executive? There are all sorts of rules that limit the power of the executive, that even if you end up with one, it's very clear that they also have to follow the rules of the Torah. And if they don't follow the rules of the Torah, then they could be taken to court. And that's a very important piece to end with, right? The notion that even if we can't live up to the ideal of the Torah, that we only need the Torah, we don't need an executive. Even when we do have an executive, that executive is not above the law, right? That executive is very much, right? For example, the Torah says that the king always has to carry a Sefer Torah around, right? Which probably is because it's reminding the king that they're also governed by the rules of the Torah. Now, the rest of us are not obligated to carry a Torah around. It's a special rule for the king because since the king's power may go to the king's head, the Torah wants to make sure that that does not happen. So that's just one example of sort of a control that the Torah puts on the executive if, in fact, we end up with one. In any case, I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments or thoughts on what we've on what we have done.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good night, everyone. Lila told to everyone.
Thank you for joining.
And God protect Israel.
Amen. Amen. Yerusha Rafua Shleima to Brian Papinski, who today had cataract surgery. And
Who?
hopefully next week we'll have another one. But I think
Brian.
that's it. He only has two eyes, so that'll be it after the second one. So tell Brian we thought about him during our learning and we wish him a Rafua Shleima.
Thank you, Rabbi. I have a question.
Yes, please.
In the book of Esther, Ahasuerus says, I'm not constitutionally permitted to cancel the genocide, so I'll make a new rule and I'll let you fight back.
Right.
Today we know what a big privilege it is to be allowed to fight back. So,
Yeah.
it does Jewish tradition say that he was just faking it or that he really wasn't allowed? Did he? He's the king of 127 countries. Was he
Yes.
allowed to change a law?
You know, I wondered that myself. It does seem that even that all through the book, he's constantly conferring with his staff, and maybe
And he's
some
got
other.
two different sets of staff, it seems. The one that says this is the legal and the what you're allowed to do, and the other one that's like the PR team.
Right. So I've never seen anyone that said he was lying. It's possible, but I know I think that was the reality of the government. He was a it's an example of a king that had yeah, he had certain legislative limitations, I guess. Yeah.
Because a question that, maybe it's because I'm a new American, but this question of having laws on the law book and not enforcing them, we're going to be a sanctuary city. Does that mean we are allowed to enforce these laws? Or does that mean we are obliged to enforce these laws and in fact we are breaking the rule? Because you're making such a strong distinction between executive and judicial.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that also in our country we have federal and state. Colorado is a great example of that, right? Federally, marijuana is illegal, but in certain states it's legal, which is a strange reality. So I'm not exactly sure how those things play with each other or work with each other. Okay. If there are no other comments or questions, I will say Laila Tov. Hope to see
Island
you
Town.
all on Shabbat Shira. And thank you for joining. And I hope to see you next week when we'll be talking about Judaism and social justice. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening, everyone.
Thank you.
Shalom.
Bye.
Bye.